catch me in the act of poisoning you. I surmised. I rose, went to the door, and opened it. Ketrickin pushed past me into the room. I closed the screen quickly behind her.
He's come to poison you, she warned Rorisk.
I know, he said gravely. He put it in my wine. That's why I'm drinking his.
He refilled the glass from the carafe and offered it to her.
It's apple, he cajoled, when she shook her head.
I don't see any humor in this, she snapped,
and Rorisk and I looked at one another and grinned foolishly.
Smoke.
Her brother sighed benignly.
It's like this. Fitzchivalry realized tonight he's a dead man. Too many people have been told he is an assassin. If he kills me, you kill him. If he doesn't kill me, how can he go home and face his king? Even if his king forgives him, half the court will know he's an assassin. That makes him useless. Useless bastards are a liability to royalty.
Rorisk finished his lecture by draining the rest of his glass. Ketrickin told me that even if I killed you tonight, she would still pledge to Verity tomorrow. Again, he was not surprised.
What would she gain by refusing? Only the enmity of the six duchies.
She would be forsworn to your people, a great shame to our people. She would become outcast, to the good of no one.
It would not bring me back.
And would not your people rise up at the thought of giving her to such a man?
We would protect them from such knowledge. Eod and my sister would, anyway. Shall a whole kingdom rise to war over the death of one man? Remember, I am sacrifice here.
For the first time I dimly understood what that meant. I may very soon be an embarrassment to you, I warned him. I was told it was a slow poison, but I looked at it. It is not. It is a simple extract of dead root, and actually rather swift, if given in sufficient quantity. First, it gives a man tremors. Rorisk extended his hands on the table, and they trembled. Ketrickin looked furious with both of us. Death follows swiftly, and I expect I am supposed to be caught in the act and disposed of along with you. Rorisk clutched his throat, then let his head loll forward on his chest.
I am poisoned, he intoned theatrically.
I've had enough of this,
Ketrick spat, just as Cobb tore the door open.
Where treachery?
He cried. He went white at the sight of Ketrickin.
My lady princess, tell me you have not drunk the wine. This tedious bastard has poisoned it.
I think the drama was rather spoiled by the lack of response. Ketrickin and I exchanged looks. Rorisk rolled from his chair onto the floor.
Oh, stop it!
She hissed at him. I put the poison in the wine, I told Cobb genially, just as I was charged to do. And then Rorisk's back arched in his first convulsion. The blinding realization of how I had been duped took but an instant. Poison in the wine, a gift of Pharaoh apple wine, probably given this very evening. Regal had not trusted me to put it there, but it was easy enough to accomplish in this trusting place. I watched Rurich arch again, knowing there was nothing I could do. Already, there was the spreading numbness in my own mouth. I wondered, almost idly, how strong the dose had been. I had only a cup. Would I die here, or on a scaffold? Ketrickin herself understood, a moment later, that her brother was truly dying.
You soulless filth!
She spat at me, and then sank down at Rurisk's side.
To lull him with jests and smoke, to smile with him as he dies!
Her eyes flashed at Cobb.
I demand his death! Tell Regal to come here now!
I was moving for the door, but Cobb was faster. Of course. No smoke for Cobb this night. He was faster and more muscular than I, clearer of head. His arms closed around me, and he bore me down to the floor. His face was close to mine as he drove his fist into my belly. I knew this breath, this scent of sweat. Smithy had scented this before he died, but this time the knife was in my sleeve and very sharp and treated with the swiftest poison Chade knew. After I put it into him, he managed to hit me twice, good solid punches, before he fell back, dying. "Goodbye, Cobb." As he fell, I suddenly saw a freckly stable boy saying, "Come along now, there's some good fellows." It could have gone so many different ways. I had known this man. Killing him killed a part of my own life. Burridge was going to be very upset with me. All those thoughts had taken but a fraction of a second. Cobb's outflung hand had not struck the floor before I was moving for the door. Ketrickin was even faster. I think it was a brass water ewer. I saw it as a white burst of light. When I came to myself, everything hurt. The most immediate pain was in my wrists, for the cords that knotted them together behind my back were unbearably tight. I was being carried, sort of. Neither Raud nor Severin seemed to much care if parts of me dragged. Regal was there, with a torch, and a Chiorda I didn't know leading the way with another. I didn't know where I was either, except that we were outdoors. "Is there nowhere else we can put him? No place especially secure?" Regal was demanding. There was a muttered reply, and Regal said, "No, you're right. We do not want to raise a great outcry right now. Tomorrow is soon enough. Not that I think he will live that long." A door was opened, and I was flung headlong to an earthen floor barely cushioned by straw. I breathed dust and chaff. I could not cough. Regal gestured with his torch. "Go to the princess," he instructed Severance. "Tell her I will be there shortly. See if there is anything we can do to make the prince more comfortable. You, Raud, summon August from his chambers. We will need his skill, so that King Shrewd may know how he has succored a scorpion. I will need his approval before the bastard dies. If he lives long enough to be condemned, go on now. Go!" And they left, the Chiorda lighting their way for them. Regal remained, looking down on me. He waited until their footfalls were distant, before he kicked me savagely in the ribs. I cried out wordlessly, for my mouth and throat were numb. "It seems we have been here before, have we not? You wallowing in straw and me looking down on you, wondering what misfortune had brought you into my life. Odd how so many things end as they begin. And so much of justice is a circle also. Consider how you fall to poison and treachery, just as my mother did. Ah, you start. Did you think I did not know? I knew. I know much you do not think I know. Everything from the stench of Lady Time to how you lost your skill when Burridge would no longer let you tap his strength. He was swift enough to abandon you when he saw it might otherwise cost him his life." A tremor shook me. Regal threw back his head and laughed. Then he gave a sigh and turned. "A pity I cannot stay and watch. But I have a princess to console. Poor thing. Pledged to a man she already hates." Either Regal left then, or I did, I am not clear. It was as if the sky opened up, and I flowed out into it. "Being open," Verity told me, "is simply not being closed." Then I dreamed, I think, of the fool, and of Verity, sleeping with his arms wrapped around his head, as if to keep his thoughts in, and of Galen's voice echoing in the dark, cold chamber. "Tomorrow is better. When he skills now, he scarce has any sense of the room he sits in. We do not have enough bond for me to do this from a distance. A touch will be required." There was a squeaking in the dark, a disagreeable mouse of a mind that I did not know. "Do it now," it insisted. "Do not be foolish," Galen rebuked it. "Shall we lose it all now for the sake of haste? Tomorrow is soon enough. Let me worry about that part. You must tidy things there. Raud and Severins know too much, and the stable master has annoyed us too long.
You leave me standing in a bloodbath,
the mouse squeaked angrily. Wade through it to a throne, Galen suggested.
And Cobb is dead. Who will see to my horses on the way home?
Leave the stable master, then, Galen said in disgust, and then, considering, I will do him myself when you get home. I shall not mind. But the others were better done quickly. Perhaps the bastard poisoned other wine in your quarters. A pity your servants got into it.
I suppose. You must find me a new valet.
We will have your wife do that for you. You should be with her now. She has just lost her brother. You must be horrified at what has come to pass. Try to blame the bastard rather than Verity, but not too convincingly. And tomorrow, when you are as bereaved as she, well, we shall see what mutual sympathy leads to. She is as big as a cow and as pale as a fish. But with the mountain lands, you will have a defensible inland kingdom. You know the coastal duchies will not stand for you, and Pharaoh and Tilth cannot stand alone between the mountains and the coastal duchies. Besides, she need not live longer than her first child's birth.
Fits chivalry farcier,
Verity said in his sleep. King Shrewd and Chade played at dice-bones together. Patience stirred in her sleep.
Chivalry?
She asked softly.
Is that you?
No, I said. It's no one. No one at all.
She nodded and slept on. When my eyes focused again, it was dark, and I was alone. My jaws trembled, and my chin and shirt front were wet with my own saliva. The numbness seemed less. I wondered if that meant the poison wouldn't kill me. I doubted that it mattered. I would have small chance to speak in my own behalf. My hands had gone numb. At least they didn't hurt any more. I was horribly thirsty. I wondered if Rurisk was dead yet. He had taken a lot more of the wine than I had, and Chade had said it was quick. As if in answer to my question, a cry of purest pain rose to the moon. The ululation seemed to hang there, and to pull my heart out with it as it rose. Nosey's master was dead. I flung myself toward him, wrapped the wit around him. I know, I know. And we shivered together, as one he had loved passed beyond reach. The great aloneness wrapped us together.
Boy?
Faint, but true. A paw and a nose, and a door edged open. He padded toward me, his nose telling me how bad I smelled. Smoke and blood and fear sweat. When he reached me, he lay down beside me and put his head on my back. With the touch came the bond again, stronger now that Rurisk was gone.
He left me. It hurts.
I know. A long time passed.
Free me?
The old dog lifted his head. Men cannot grieve as dogs do. We should be grateful for that. But from the depths of his anguish he still rose and set worn teeth to my bonds. I felt them loosen, a strand at a time, but had not even the strength to pull them apart. Nosey turned his head to set his back teeth to them. At last, the thongs parted. I pulled my arms forward. That made everything hurt differently. I still could not feel my hands, but I could roll over and get my face out of the straw. Nosey and I sighed together. He put his head on my chest, and I wrapped a stiff arm around him. Another tremor shook me. My muscles clenched and unclenched themselves so violently that I saw dots of light. But it passed, and I still breathed. I opened my eyes again. Light blinded me, but I did not know if it was real. Beside me, Nosey's tail thumped the straw. Burridge slowly sank down beside us. He put a gentle hand on Nosey's back as my eyes adjusted to his lantern. I could see the grief in his face.
"Are you dying?"
he asked me. His voice was so neutral, it was like hearing a stone speak. "I'm not sure." That was what I tried to say. My mouth still wasn't working very well. He rose and walked away. He took the lantern with him. I lay alone in the dark. Then the light came back, and Burridge with a bucket of water. He lifted my head and sloshed some into my mouth.
"Don't swallow it,"
he cautioned me. But I couldn't have made those muscles work anyway. He washed out my mouth twice more, and then half-drowned me, trying to get me to drink some. I fended off the bucket with a wooden hand.
"No,"
I managed. After a bit, my head seemed to clear. I moved my tongue against my teeth and could feel them.
"I killed Cobb,"
I told him.
"I know. They brought his body out to the stables. No one wanted to tell me anything."
"How did you know to find me?"
He sighed.
"I just had a feeling."
"You heard Nosy?"
"Yes. The howling."
"That isn't what I meant."
He was quiet a long time.
"Sensing a thing isn't the same as using a thing."
I couldn't think of anything to say back to that. After a while, I said,
"Cobb is the one who knifed you on the stairs."
"Was he?"
Burridge considered.
"I had wondered why the dogs barked so little." "They knew him." "Only Smithy reacted."
My hands screamed suddenly to life. I folded them to my chest and rocked over them. Nosy whined.
"Stop it,"
Burridge hissed.
"Just now I can't help it," I replied. "It all hurts so bad, I'm spilling out all over."
Burridge was silent.
"Are you going to help me?"
I asked finally.
"I don't know,"
he said softly, and then, almost pleadingly,
"Fitz, what are you? What have you become?"
"I am what you are,"
I told him honestly.
"A king's man.
Burridge, they're going to kill Verity. If they do, Regal will become king."
"What are you talking about?"
"If we stay here while I explain it all, it will happen. Help me get out of here."
He seemed to take a very long time to think about it, but in the end, he helped me to stand, and I held on to his sleeve as I staggered out of the stables and into the night. 23. The Wedding. The art of diplomacy is the luck of knowing more of your rival's secrets than he knows of yours. Always deal from a position of power. These were Shrewd's maxims, and Verity abided by them.
"You have to get to August. He's the only hope Verity has."
We were sitting in the greyness before dawn on a hillside above the palace. We had not gotten far. The terrain was steep, and I was in no condition for hiking. I was beginning to suspect that Regal's kick had renewed Galen's old damage to my ribs. Every deep breath stabbed me. Regal's poison still sent tremors through me, and my legs buckled often and unpredictably. Alone I could not stand, for my legs would not support me. I could not even cling to a tree trunk and hold myself upright. There was no strength in my arms. Around us, in the dawn forest, birds called, squirrels were gathering stores for the winter, and insects chirred. It was hard, in the midst of all that life, to wonder how much of this damage was permanent. Were the days and strength of my youth already spent, and nothing left to me but trembling and weakness? I tried to push the question from my mind, to concentrate on the greater problems facing the six duchies. I stilled myself as Chade had taught me. Around us, the trees were immense, with a presence like peace. I understood why Eod would not cut them for timber. The needles were soft beneath us, the fragrance soothing. I wished I could just lie back and sleep, light Nosy at my side. Our pains still mingled together, but at least Nosy could escape his in sleep.
"What makes you think August would help us?"
Burrich asked.
"If I could get him out here."
I pulled my thoughts back to our dilemma. "I don't think he's involved with the rest of it. I think he is still loyal to the king." I had presented my information to Burrich as my own careful conclusions. He was not a man likely to be convinced by phantom voices overheard in my head, so I could not tell him that Galen had not suggested killing August, and therefore he was probably ignorant of their plot. I was still unsure myself of what I had experienced. Regal could not skill, even if he could. How could I have overheard skilling between two others? No. It had to be something else, some other magic. Of Galen's devising? Was he capable of a magic that strong? I did not know. So much I do not know. I forced myself to set it all aside, for now it fit the facts I had better than any other supposition I could imagine.
"If he's loyal to the king and has no suspicions of Regal, then he is loyal to Regal as well,"
Burrich pointed out, as if I were a witling. "Then we'll have to force him somehow. Verity must be warned."
"Of course. I'll just walk in, put a knife to August's back, and march him out of there. No one will bother us."
I floundered for ideas. "Bribe someone to lure him out here, then jump him."
"Even if I knew someone bribable, what would we use?"
"I have this." I touched the earring in my ear. Burrich looked at it, and almost jumped.
"Where did you get that?"
"Patience gave it to me. Right before I left."
"She had no right."
And then, more quietly,
"I thought it went to his grave with him."
I was silent, waiting. Burrich looked aside.
"It was your father's. I gave it to him."
He spoke quietly.
"Why?"
"Because I wanted to, obviously."
He closed the topic. I reached up and began to unfasten it.
"No," he said gruffly. "Keep it where it is. But it is not a thing to be spent on a bribe. These Chiurda can't be bribed anyway."
I knew he was right about that. I tried to think of other plans. The sun was coming up, morning, when Galen would act. Perhaps had already acted. I wished I knew what was going on in the palace below. Did they know I was missing? Was Ketriken preparing to pledge herself to a man she would hate? Were Severins and Raud dead yet? If not, could I turn them against Regal by warning them?
"Someone's coming."
Burrich flattened himself. I lay back, resigned to whatever happened. I had no physical fight left in me.
"You know her?"
Burrich breathed. I turned my head. Chongqui, preceded by a little dog that would never climb a tree for Rurisk again. "The king's sister." I didn't bother whispering. She was carrying one of my nightshirts, and an instant later the tiny dog was leaping joyously around us. He romped invitingly at Nosy, but Nosy just looked at him mournfully. An instant later, Chongqui strode up to us.
"You must come back," she said to me without preamble. "And you must hurry."
"Hard enough to come back," I told her,
"without hurrying to my death."
I was watching behind her for other trackers. Burrich had risen and taken a defensive posture over me.
"No death," she promised me calmly. "Ketriken has forgiven you. I have been counseling her since last night, but only lately convinced her. She has invoked her kin right to forgive kin for injury to kin. By our law, if kin forgive kin, no other can do otherwise. Your Regal sought to dissuade her, but only made her angry. Here, while I am in this place, I can still invoke the law of the mountain people," she told him. "King Eod agreed. Not because he does not mourn Rurisk, but because the strength and wisdom of Jampe law must be respected by all. So,
You must come back.
I considered. And have you forgiven me?
No,
she snorted.
I do not forgive my nephew's murderer, but I cannot forgive you for what you did not do. I do not believe you would drink wine you had poisoned, not even a little. Those of us who know best the dangers of poison tempt them least. You would have just pretended to drink, and never spoken of poison at all. No. This was done by someone who believes himself very clever, and believes others are very stupid.
I felt, rather than saw Burridge, lower his guard, but I couldn't completely relax.
Why can't Ketrickin just forgive me and let me go away? Why must I come back? There is no time for this!
Jonqui hissed, and it was the closest I had seen to an angry Chiorda.
Shall I take months and years to teach you all I know about balances? For a pull, a push. For a breath, a sigh. Do you think no one can feel how power slews and tilts just now? A princess must endure being bartered away like a cow. But my niece is not a playing piece to be won in a dice game. Whoever killed my nephew clearly wished you to die also. Shall I let him win that toss? I think not. I do not know who I wish to win. Until I do, I will let no player be eliminated.
That's logic, I understand, Burridge said approvingly. He stooped and hauled me suddenly to my feet. The world rocked alarmingly. Chongqui came to put her shoulder under my other arm. They walked, and my feet marionetted across the ground between them. Nosey heaved himself to his feet and followed, and so we returned to the palace at Jumpe. Burich and Jonqui took me right through the people gathered all throughout the grounds and palace to my room. I actually excited little interest. I was just an outlander who had had too much wine and smoke last night. People were too absorbed in finding good places from which to view the dais to worry about me. There was no air of mourning, so I assumed the word of Ruarisk's death had not been released. When we finally entered my room, Jonqui's placid face darkened.
I did not do this. I only took a nightshirt to give Ruta a scent.
This was the disassembly of my room. It had been thoroughly, if not discreetly, done. Jonqui immediately set to putting things right, and after a moment, Burridge helped her. I sat in a chair and tried to make sense of the situation. Nosey, unnoticed, curled up in a corner. I unthinkingly extended comfort to him. Burridge immediately glanced at me, then at the woebegone dog. He looked away. When Jonqui left to fetch washwater and food for me, I asked Burridge, "Have you found a tiny wooden chest, carved with acorns?" He shook his head. So they had taken my poison cache. I would have liked to prepare another dagger, or even a powder to fling. Burridge could not be always beside me to protect me, and I certainly couldn't fend off an attacker, or run away in my present condition. But my trade tools were gone. I would have to hope I wouldn't need them. I suspected Raud was the one who had been here, and wondered if this had been his last act. Jonqui returned with water and food, and then excused herself. Burridge and I shared washwater, and with some help, I managed to change into clean, if simple, clothes. Burridge ate an apple. My stomach quailed at the mere thought of food, but I drank the water, cold from the well, that Jonqui had brought me. Getting my throat muscles to swallow still took conscious effort, and I felt like the water sloshed unpleasantly inside me. But I suspected it was good for me. And I felt each moment ticking by, and wondered when Galen would make his move. The screen slid aside. I looked up, expecting Jonqui again. But August entered on a wave of contempt. He spoke immediately, anxious to do his errand and depart. "I do not come here of my own volition. I come at the bidding of the king-in-waiting, Verity, to speak his words for him. This is his message exactly.
He is grieved beyond telling by—
You skilled to him? Today, was he well?
August seethed at my question. He was scarcely well. He is grieved beyond telling at Rurisk's death, and at your betrayal. He bids you to draw strength from those around you loyal to you, for you will need it to face him.
Is that all? I asked.
From the king-in-waiting, Verity, it is. Prince Regal bids you to attend upon him, and swiftly, for the time of the ceremony is only hours away, and he must be attired for it, and your cowardly poison, no doubt meant for Regal, has found poor Severins and Roud. Now Regal must do with an untrained valet. It will take him longer to dress, so do not keep him waiting. He is in the steams, to try to restore himself. You may find him there.
How tragic for him, an untrained valet,
Burich said acidly. August puffed up like a toad. It is scarcely humorous. Have not you lost Cobb as well to this scoundrel? How can you bear to aid him?
If your ignorance were not protecting you, August, I might dispel it.
Burrett stood, looking dangerous. You too will face charges, August warned him as he retreated. I am to say to you, Burrett, that King-in-Waiting Verity is not unaware of how you attempted to help the bastards escape, serving him as if you were king instead of Verity. You will be judged.
Did Verity say so?
Burrich asked, curiously. He did. He said you were once the best of king's men to chivalry, but apparently you had forgotten how to aid those who truly serve the king. Recall it, he bids you, and assures you of his great wrath if you do not return to stand before him and receive what your deed merits.
I recall it only too well. I will bring Fitz to Regal.
Now?
As soon as he is eaten.
August glowered at him and left. Screens cannot be effectively slammed, but he tried.
I have no stomach to eat, Burrich, I protested.
I know that, but we need time for this.
I marked Verity's choice of words and found more in them than August did. Did you?
I nodded, feeling defeated.
I understood also, but it is beyond me.
Are you sure?
Verity does not think so, and he knows of such things. And you told me that was why Cobb tried to kill me, because they suspected you of drawing on my strength. So Galen believes you can do it too. Burrich crossed to me, and went down stiffly on one knee. His bad legs stretched awkwardly behind him. He took my lax hand and placed it on his shoulder.
I was king's man to chivalry,
he told me quietly.
Verity knew it. I have no skill myself, you understand. But chivalry gave me to understand that for such a taking it was not as important as the friendship between us. I have strength, and there were few times that he needed it, and I gave it willingly. So I have withstood this before in worse circumstances.
Try, boy. If we fail, we fail, but at least we will have tried.
I don't know. I don't know how to skill, and I certainly don't know how to tap someone else's strength to do it, and even if I did, if I succeeded, I might kill you.
If you succeed, our king may live. That is what I am sworn to. And you?
He made it all seem so simple. So I tried. I opened my mind. I reached for Verity. I tried, with no idea how, to draw strength from Burrich. But all I heard was the twittering of birds outside the palace walls, and Burrich's shoulder was only a place to rest my hand. I opened my eyes. I didn't have to tell him I'd failed. He knew. He sighed heavily.
"Well, I suppose I take you to Regal," he said.
"If we did not go, we would be forever curious as to what he wanted," I added. Burrich did not smile.
"You have a fey mood on you," he said. "You sound more like the fool than yourself."
"Does the fool talk to you?" I asked curiously.
sometimes,
he said, and took my arm to help me up. It seems like the closer I walk to death, I told him, the funnier things seem.
To you, perhaps, he said crossly. I wonder what he wants.
To bargain. There can be nothing else. And if he wants to bargain, we may be able to gain something.
You speak as if Regal follows the same rules of common sense as the rest of us. I've never known him to do that, and I've always hated court intrigue,
Burridge complained.
I'd rather clean stalls.
He pulled me again to my feet. If I had ever wondered how Deadroot felt to its victim, I knew it now. I did not think I would die of it, but I did not know how much of a life it would leave me either. My legs trembled under me, and my grip was uncertain. I could feel random muscle twitches throughout my body. Neither my breath nor the beating of my heart was predictable. I longed to be still, where I could listen to my own body and decide what had been done to it. But Burridge guided my steps patiently, and Nosey drooped along behind us. I had not been to the Steams before, but Burridge had. A separate tulip bud enclosed a bubbling hot spring, tamed to use as a bath. A Chiurda stood outside it. I recognized him as the torchbearer from the night before. If he thought anything odd about my reappearance, he did not show it. He stepped aside as if expecting us, and Burridge dragged me up the steps to enter. Clouds of steam fogged the air, carrying a mineral scent with them. We passed a stone bench or two. Burridge walked carefully on the smooth tile floor as we approached the source of the steam. The water rose in a central spring, with bricked sides built up around it to contain it. From there it was channeled in troughs to other smaller baths, varying the heat by the length of the trough and the depth of the pond. The steam and the noise of the falling water filled the air. I did not find it pleasant. I labored just to breathe already. My eyes adjusted to the dimness, and I saw Regal soaking in one of the larger baths. He looked up at our approach.
Ah, he said, as if well pleased. August told me Burridge would bring you. Well, I suppose you know the princess has forgiven your murder of her brother. And in this place, at least, by doing so she preserves you from justice. I think it a waste of time, but local customs must be honored. She says she considers you part of her kin group now, and so I must treat you as kin. She fails to understand you were not born of lawful union, and hence have no kin rights at all. Ah, well. Will you dismiss Burridge and join me in the springs? It might ease you. You look very uncomfortable.
Held up like a shirt on the washline. He spoke so generally, so affably, as if unaware of my hatred. What do you wish to tell me, Regal? I kept my voice flat.
Will you not send Burridge away?
He asked again.
I am not a fool.
One could argue that, but very well. I suppose I must send him away, then. The steam and the noise of the waters had cloaked the Chiurda well. He was taller than Burridge, and his cudgel was already in motion as Burridge turned. If he hadn't been supporting my weight, he could have avoided it. Burridge turned his head, but the cudgel hit his skull with a terrible, sharp sound, like an axe biting wood. Burridge fell, and I with him. I landed half in one of the smaller ponds. It was not scalding, but nearly so. I managed to roll out of it, but could not regain my feet. My legs would not obey me. Burridge, beside me, lay very still. I reached a hand toward him, but could not touch him. Regal stood up and motioned to the Chiurda.
Dead?
The Chiurda stirred Burridge with a foot, gave a curt nod.
Good.
Regal was briefly pleased.
Drag him back behind that deep tank in the corner, then you may go.
To me, he said, it's unlikely anyone will be coming in here until after the ceremony. They're too busy, jostling for positions. And back in that corner, well, I doubt if he'll be found before you are. I could make no response. The Chiurda stooped and seized Burrich by the ankles. As he dragged him away, the dark brush of his hair feathered a trail of blood on the tiles. A dizzying mixture of hatred and despair roiled with the poison through my body. A cold purpose rose and set in me. I could not hope to live now, but it did not seem important. Warning Verity did, and avenging Burrich. I had no plans, no weapons, no possibilities. So play for time, Chade's counsel advised me. The more time you create for yourself, the better the chance that something will present itself. Delay him. Perhaps someone will come to see why the prince is not dressing for the wedding. Perhaps someone else will want to use the steams before the ceremony. Engage him somehow. The princess, I began, is not a problem. Regal finished for me. The princess did not forgive Burrich, only you. What I have done to him is well within my rights. He is a traitor. He must pay. And the man disposing of him was most fond of his prince, Rurisk. He has no objections to any of this. The Chiurda left the steams without a glance back. My hands scrabbled weakly on the smooth tile floor, but found no purchase. Regal busily dried himself all the while. When the man was gone, he came to stand over me. "Aren't you going to call for help?" he asked brightly. I took a breath, pushed down my fear. I mustered as much contempt for Regal as I could find. To whom? Who would hear me over the water? "So save your strength. Wise. Pointless, but wise. Do you think Ketriken will not know what happened? She will know you went to the steams, unwisely in your condition." You slipped beneath the hot, hot water. Such a shame. Regal, this is madness. How many bodies do you think you can leave in your wake? How will you explain Burrich's death?
To your first question, quite a few, as long as they are not people of consequence.
He stooped over me and gripped my shirt. He dragged me while I thrashed weakly, a fish out of water. And to your second, well, the same. How much fuss do you think anyone will raise over a dead stableman? You are so obsessed with your plebeian self-importance that you extend it to your servants. He dumped me carelessly, half atop Burrich. His still warm body sprawled face down on the floor. Blood was congealing on the tiles around his face and still dripping from his nose. A slow bubble of blood formed on his lips, broke with his faint exhalation. He lived still. I shifted to conceal it from Regal. If I could survive, Burrich might have a chance also. Regal noticed nothing. He tugged my boots off and set them aside.
"You see, bastard,"
he said as he paused to catch his breath.
"Ruthlessness creates its own rules."
So my mother taught me. People are intimidated by a man who acts with no apparent regard for consequences. Behave as if you cannot be touched, and no one will dare to touch you. Look at the whole situation. Your death will anger some people, yes, but enough to make them take actions that would affect the security of the whole six duchies? I think not. Besides, your death will be eclipsed by other things. I'd be a fool not to take this opportunity to remove you. Regal was so damnably calm and superior. I fought him. But he was surprisingly strong for the indulgent life he led. I felt like a kitten as he shook me out of my shirt. He folded my clothes neatly and set them aside. Minimal alibis will work. If I made too much effort to appear guiltless, people might think I cared. They might start then to pay attention themselves. So I simply know nothing. My man saw you enter with Burrich after I had left. And I go now to complain to August that you never came to talk with me so that I might forgive you, as I had promised Princess Ketriken. I will reprimand August most severely for not bringing you himself. He looked around. Let's see. A nice, deep, hot one. Right here. I clutched at his throat as he levered me up to the edge, but he shook me off easily.
"Goodbye, bastard,"
he said calmly. "Pardon my haste, but you have quite delayed me, and I must rush to dress myself, or I shall be late for the wedding." And he tumbled me in. The pool was deeper than I was tall, designed to be neck-high on a tall ciurda. It was painfully hot to my unprepared body. It drove the air from my lungs, and I sank. I pushed feebly off the bottom and managed to get my face above water. "Burich!" I wasted my breath on a shout to someone who could not aid me. The water closed on me again. My arms and legs would not work together. I blundered into a wall and pushed myself under before I could once again surface and gasp in some air. The hot water was loosening my already flaccid muscles. I think I would still have been drowning even if the water had been only knee-deep. I lost count of how many times I floundered to the surface to gasp a breath. The smooth, worked stone of the walls eluded my palsied grip, and my ribs stabbed me with pain each time I tried for a deep breath. My strength was flowing out of me, lassitude flowing in. So warm. So deep. Drowned like a puppy, I thought to myself, as I felt the darkness closing. "Boy?" someone queried, but all was black. So much water, so hot and so deep. I could not find a bottom any more, let alone a side. I struggled feebly against the water, but there was no resistance. No up, no down. No use fighting to stay alive inside my body, nothing left to protect. So drop the walls, and see if there is one last service you can render your king. The walls of my world fell away with me, and I sped forth like an arrow finally released. Galen had been right. There was no distance in skilling, no distance at all. Buckkeep was right here, and shrewd. I shrieked in desperation, but my king was intent upon other things. He was closed and walled to me, no matter how I stormed around him. No help there. Strength was going from me. Somewhere I was drowning. My whole body was failing. My thread to it was tenuous. One last chance. "Verity! Verity!" I cried. I found him, flailed at him, but could find no purchase, no grip. He was elsewhere, open to someone else, closed to me. "Verity!" I wailed, drowning in despair. And suddenly, it was as if strong hands gripped mine as I scrabbled up a slippery cliff, gripped and held tight, and drew me in when I would have slipped away. "Chivalry? No, it can't be. It's the boy. Fitz?" "You imagine things, my prince. There is no one there. Attend to what we do now." Galen, calm and insidious as poison, as he pushed me aside. I could not withstand him, he was too strong. "Fitz?" Verity, unsure now as I grew weaker. From I knew not where, I found strength. Something gave way before me, and I was strong. I clung to Verity like a hawk on his wrist. I was there with him. I saw with Verity's eyes the freshly decked throne room, the book of events on the great table before him, laid open to receive the recording of Verity's marriage. Around him in their best finery and most costly jewels, the few honored ones who had been invited to witness Verity witnessing his bride's pledge through August's eyes. And Galen, who was supposed to be offering his strength as a king's man, was poised beside and slightly behind Verity, waiting to drain him dry. And Shrewd, in crown and robe upon his throne, was all unknowing, his skill burned and dulled away, years ago by misuse, and him too proud to admit it. Like an echo, I saw through August's eyes as Ketriken stood pale as a wax candle on a dais before all her people. She was telling them, simply and kindly, that last night, Rurisk had finally succumbed to the arrow wound he had taken on the ice fields. She hoped to please his memory by pledging herself, as he had helped arrange, to the king-in-waiting of the six duchies. She turned to face Regal. In Buckkeep, Galen's claw of a hand settled on Verity's shoulder. I broke into his link with Verity, pushed him aside. Beware Galen, Verity. Beware a traitor. Come to drain you dry. Touch him not. Galen's hand tightened on Verity's shoulder. Suddenly, all was a sucking vortex, draining, trying to pull everything out of Verity. And there was not much left to take. His skill was so strong because he let it take so much from him so fast. Self-preservation would have made another man hold back some of his strength. But Verity had been spending his recklessly every day to keep the red ships from his shores. So little left now for this ceremony, and Galen was absorbing it, and growing stronger as he did so. I clung to Verity, fighting desperately to reduce the loss. Verity! I cried to him. My prince! I sensed a brief rallying in him, but all was growing dim before his eyes. I heard a stirring of alarm as he sagged and caught the table. Faithless Galen kept his grip on him, bent over him as he bent to one knee, murmuring solicitously. My prince? Are you quite all right? I flung my strength to Verity, reserves I had not suspected in myself. I opened up and let go of them, just as Verity did when he skilled. I had not known I had so much to give. Take it all. I would die anyway. And you were always good to me when I was young. I heard the words as clearly as if I had spoken them, and felt the breaking of a mortal bond as strength flowed into Verity through me. He waxed suddenly strong, beast strong, and angry. Verity's hand rose to grip Galen's. He opened his eyes. I shall be fine, he said to Galen, aloud. He looked around the room as he rose to his feet again. I but worried about you. You seem to tremble. Are you sure you are strong enough for this? You must not attempt a challenge that is beyond you. Think what might happen. And as a gardener pulls a weed from the earth, Verity smiled and pulled from the traitor all that was in him. Galen fell, clutching his chest, an empty man-shaped thing. The onlookers rushed to attend him, but Verity, replete now, lifted his eyes to the window and focused his mind afar.
August, attend me well. Warn Regal his half-brother is dead.
Verity boomed like the sea, and I felt August quail at the strength of the skilling.
Galen was too ambitious. He attempted that which was beyond his skill. A pity the queen's bastard could not be content with the position she gave him. A pity my younger brother could not dissuade his half-brother from his misplaced ambitions. Galen overstepped his position. My younger brother should take heed of what comes of such recklessness, and August, be sure you tell Regal privately. Not many knew Galen was the queen's bastard and his half-brother. I am sure he would not want scandal to soil his mother's name or his. Such family secrets should be well guarded. And then, with a force that put August on his knees, Verity pushed through him to stand before Ketrickin in her mind. I sensed his effort to be gentle. I await you, my queen-in-waiting, and by my name I swear to you, I had naught to do with your brother's death. I knew nothing of it, and I grieve with you. I would not want you to come to me, thinking his blood on my hands. Like a jewel opening was the light in Verity's heart as he exposed it to her, that she might know she had not been given to a murderer. Selflessly, he made himself vulnerable to her, giving trust to build trust. She swayed but stood. August fainted. The contact was gone. And then Verity was shoving at me. Back. Get back, Fitz. That's too much. You'll die. Back. Let go.
and he cuffed me like a bear, and I slammed back into my silent, sightless body. 24. The Aftermath. In the great library at Jumpy, there is a tapestry that is rumored to contain a map through the mountains to the Rain Wilds. Like many Jumpy maps and books, the information contained was considered so valuable that it was encoded in the forms of riddles and visual puzzles. Figured on the tapestry among many images are the forms of a dark-haired, dark man, stout and muscular, and bearing a red shield, and in the opposite corner, a golden-skinned being. The golden-skinned creature has been the victim of moths and fraying, but it is still possible to see that in the scale of the tapestry, it is much larger than a human, and possibly winged. Buckkeep legend has it that King Wisdom sought and found the Elderling's homeland by a secret path through the Mountain Kingdom. Could these figures represent an Elderling and King Wisdom? Does this tapestry record the path through the Mountain Kingdom to the Elderling's homeland in the Rain Wilds? Much later, I learned how I had been found, leaning against Burridge's body on the tile floor of the steams. I was shaking as with an ague, and could not be roused. Chong Kui found us, though how she knew to look in the steams I will never know. I will always suspect that she was to Eod, as Chade was to Shrewd, not as assassin, perhaps, but as one who had ways of knowing or finding out almost anything that happened within the palace. However it was, she took command of the situation. Burridge and I were isolated in a chamber separate from the palace, and I suspect that for a while, no one from Buckkeep knew where we were, or if we lived. She tended us herself with the aid of an old manservant. I awoke some 2 days after the wedding. 4 of the most miserable days of my life were spent lying in bed, limbs a-twitch, but not at my command. I dozed often, in a deadened way that was not pleasant, and either dreamed vividly of Verity, or sensed him trying to skill to me. The skill dreams conveyed no sense to me, other than that he was concerned for me. I grasped only isolated bits of knowledge from them, such as the color of the curtains in the room he skilled from, or the feel of a ring on his finger that he absently twisted as he tried to reach me. Some more violent jerk of my muscles would shake me from my dreams, and my spasming would torment me until, exhausted, I dozed again. My periods of alertness were as bad, for Burridge lay on a pallet in the same room, breathing hoarsely, but doing little more than that. His features were swollen and discolored, such that he was barely recognizable. From the beginning, Chong Kui gave me little hope for him, either that he would live, or that he would be himself if he did survive. But Burridge had cheated death before. The swelling gradually subsided, the purpling faded, and when he did awaken, he proceeded to recover himself swiftly. He had no memories of anything that occurred after he took me from the stable. I told him only what he needed to know. It was more than it was safe for him to know, but I owed it to him. He was up and about before I was, though at first he had times of dizziness and headaches. But before long, Burridge was getting to know the Jumpy stables and exploring the town at his leisure. In the evenings he would return, and we had many long, quiet conversations. We both avoided topics where we knew we would disagree, and there were areas, such as Chade's teachings, where I could not be open with him. Mostly, though, we talked about dogs he had known, and horses he'd trained, and sometimes he spoke, a little, of his early days with chivalry. One evening, I told him about Molly. He was quiet for a time, and then told me that he'd heard the owner of the Bee-Bomb Chandlery had died in debt, and that his daughter, who had expected to inherit it, had gone to live with relatives in a village instead. He did not remember what village, but knew someone who would know. He did not mock me, but told me seriously that I should know my own mind before I saw her again. August never skilled again. He was carried from the dais that day, but as soon as he recovered from his faint, he demanded to see Regal immediately. I trust he delivered Verity's message, for while Regal did not come to visit either Burridge or me during our convalescence, Kettricken did, and she mentioned that Regal was most concerned that we recover quickly and completely from our accidents, for as he had promised her, he had forgiven me completely. She told me how Burridge had slipped and struck his head, trying to pull me from the pool, when I went into a seizure. I do not know who concocted that tale. Jonqui herself, perhaps. I doubt if even Chade could have come up with a better one, but Verity's message was the end of August's leadership of the Coterie, and all Skilling, as far as I know. I do not know if he was too afraid after that day, or if the talent was blasted out of him by that force. He left the court and went to Withywoods, where chivalry and patience had once ruled. I believe he became wise. Following her wedding, Kettricken joined with all of Jampe in a month of mourning for her brother. From my sickbed, I was aware of it mostly as chimes, chantings, and great burnings of incense. All Rurisk's possessions were given away. To me, Eod himself came, and brought a simple silver ring his son had worn, and the head of the arrow that had pierced his chest. He did not say much to me, except to tell me what the objects were, and that I should cherish these reminders of an exceptional man. He left me to wonder why these items had been selected for me. At the end of a month, Kettricken set her mourning aside. She came to bid Burridge and me a swift recovery, and to bid us farewell until she saw us at Buckkeep. The brief moment of Skilling from Verity had eliminated all her reservations about him. She spoke of her husband with a quiet pride, and went willingly to Buckkeep, knowing herself given to an honorable man. It was not for me to ride alongside her at the head of that homeward procession, or to enter Buckkeep, preceded by horns and tumblers and children ringing bells. That was Regal's place, and he put a gracious face on it. Regal appeared to take Verity's warning to heart. I do not think Verity ever completely forgave him. But he dismissed Regal's plottings as if they were nasty, boyish tricks, and I think that cowed Regal more than any public reprimand could have. The poisoning was eventually blamed on Raud and Severins by those who knew of it. Severins had, after all, obtained the poison, and Raud had delivered the gift of apple wine. Kettricken pretended to be convinced that it was a misplaced ambition by servants on behalf of an unknowing master. And Rurisk's death was never openly spoken of as a poisoning, nor did I become known as an assassin. Whatever was in Regal's heart, his outward demeanor was that of a younger prince graciously escorting his brother's bride home. I had a long convalescence. Chongqui treated me with herbs she said would rebuild what had been damaged. I should have tried to learn her herbs and techniques, but my mind could not seem to hold things any better than my hands could. I actually remember little of that time. My recovery from the poisoning was frustratingly slow. Chongqui sought to make it less tedious by arranging time for me in the great library. But my eyes wearied quickly, and seemed as prone to trembling disorders as my hands. I spent most days lying in my bed, thinking. For a time, I wondered if I wanted to return to Buckkeep. I wondered if I could still be Shrewd's assassin. I knew, if I returned, I would have to sit down table from Regal and look up, to see him at my king's left hand. I would have to treat him as if he had never tried to kill me, nor used me in the poisoning of a man I had admired. I spoke of it frankly one evening to Burridge. He sat and listened quietly. Then he said, "I cannot imagine it will be easier for Kettricken than it would be for you, nor for me, to look at a man who has tried to kill me twice, and call him my prince. You must decide.
I should hate to have him think he had frightened us away. But if you decide we are going elsewhere, then we shall.
I think I finally guessed then what the earring signified. Winter was no longer a threat, but a reality, when we left the mountains. Burrich, Hans, and I returned much later to Buckkeep than the others, for we took our time on the journey. I tired easily, and my strength was still very unpredictable. I would crumble at odd moments, falling from the saddle like a sack of grain. Then they would stop to help me remount, and I would force myself to go on. Many nights I awoke shaking, without even the strength to call out. These lapses were slow to pass. Worst, I think, were the nights when I could not waken, but dreamed only of endlessly drowning. From one such dream, I awoke to Verity standing over me.
"You're enough to wake the dead,"
he told me genially.
"We must find a master for you, to teach you some control, if nothing else. Ketrickin finds it a bit peculiar that I dream so often of drowning. I suppose I should be grateful you slept well on my wedding night, at least."
"Verity?" I said groggily.
"Go back to sleep," he told me.
"Galen is dead, and I've put Regal on a shorter leash. You've nothing to fear. Go to sleep. And stop dreaming so loud.
Verity, wait."
But my act of groping after him broke the tenuous skill contact, and I had no choice but to do as he advised. We traveled on through increasingly unpleasant weather. We all looked forward to getting home long before we arrived there. Burrich had, I believe, overlooked Hans's abilities until that trip. Hans had a quiet competence that inspired trust in horses as well as dogs. Eventually, he easily replaced both Cobb and me in the Buckkeep stables, and the friendship that grew between Burrich and him caused me to be more aware of my aloneness than I care to admit. Galen's death was considered a tragic thing at Buckkeep Court. Those who had known him least spoke most kindly about him. Obviously, the man had overstrained himself, for his heart to fail him so young. There was some talk of naming a warship after him, as if he were a fallen hero. But Verity never recognized the idea, and it never came to pass. His body was sent back to Pharaoh for burial, with all honors. If Shrewd suspected anything of what had gone on between Verity and Galen, he kept it well hidden. Neither he nor even Chade ever mentioned it to me. The loss of our skill master, with not even an apprentice to replace him, was no trivial thing, especially with the red ships on our horizons. That was what was openly discussed, but Verity flatly refused to consider Serene or any of the others Galen had trained. I never found out if Shrewd had given me over to Regal. I never asked him, nor even mentioned my suspicions to Chade. I suppose I didn't want to know. I tried not to let it affect my loyalties, but in my heart when I said, "My king," I meant Verity. The timbers Rurisk had promised came to Buckkeep. They had to be dragged overland to the Vin River before they could be rafted down to Tur Lake, and thence down to Buck River to Buckkeep. They arrived by midwinter and were all Rurisk had said they would be. The first completed warship was named after him. I think he would have understood that, but not quite approved of it. King Shrewd's plan had succeeded. It had been many years since Buckkeep had had a queen of any kind, and Ketrickin's arrival stirred interest in court life. The tragic death of her brother on her wedding eve, and the brave way she had continued, despite it, captured the imagination of the people. Her unmistakable admiration for her new husband made Verity a romantic hero even to his own folk. They were a striking couple, with her youth and pale beauty setting off Verity's quiet strength. Shrewd displayed them at balls that attracted every minor noble from every duchy, and Ketrickin spoke with intense eloquence of the need for all to band together to defeat the Red Ship raiders. So Shrewd raised his monies, and even in the storms of winter, the fortifications of the six duchies began. More towers were constructed, and folk volunteered to man them. Shipwrights vied for the honor of working on the warships, and Buckkeep Town was swollen with volunteers to man the ships. For a brief time that winter, folk believed in the legends they created, and it seemed the red ships could be defeated by sheer will alone. I mistrusted that mood, but watched as Shrewd promoted it, and wondered how he would sustain it when the realities of the forgings began again. Of one other I must speak. One dragged into that conflict and intrigue only by his loyalty to me. To the end of my days, I will bear the scars he gave me. His worn teeth sank deeply into my hand several times before he managed to drag me from that pool. How he did it, I will never know. But his head still rested on my chest when they found us. His mortal bonds to this world had broken. Nosey was dead. I believe he gave his life freely, recalling that we had been good to one another when we were puppies.
Men cannot grieve as dogs do, but we grieve for many years.
Epilogue. You are wearied, my boy says. He is standing at my elbow, and I do not know how long he has been there. He reaches forward slowly to lift the pen from my lax grip. Wearily, I regard the faltering trail of ink it has tracked down my page. I have seen that shape before, I think. But it was not ink then. A trickle of drying blood on the deck of a red ship, and mine, the hand that spilled it? Or was it a tendril of smoke rising black against a blue sky as I rode too late to warn a village of a red ship raid? Or poison swirling and unfurling yellowly in a simple glass of water, poison I had handed someone, smiling all the while? The artless curl of a strand of woman's hair left upon my pillow? Or the trail of a man's heels left in the sand as we dragged the bodies from the smoldering tower at Seal Bay? The track of a tear down a mother's cheek as she clutched her forged infant to her, despite his angry cries? Like red ships, the memories come without warning, without mercy. You should rest, the boy says again, and I realize I am sitting, staring at a line of ink on a page. It makes no sense. Here is another sheet spoiled, another effort to set aside. Put them away, I tell him, and do not object as he gathers all the sheets and stacks them haphazardly together. Herbery and history, maps and musings, all are hodgepodge in his hands, as they are in my mind. I can no longer recall what it was I set out to do. The pain is back, and it would be so easy to quiet it. But that way lies madness, as has been proven so many times before me. So instead, I send the boy to find 2 leaves of karimi and ginger root and peppermint to make a tea for me. I wonder if one day I will ask him to fetch 3 leaves of that Chiordan herb. Somewhere, a friend says softly, no. This concludes Assassin's Apprentice.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.